Grave Tone.
Welcome to Grave Tone Podcast, where horror comes to life in every form it takes. I'm Megan.
And I'm Arthur. And today, we are doing one of our favorite series that we haven't done in a while.
Oh my god.
The Childhood Trauma Series.
Ooh, it's been ages.
It's been way too long.
I know.
And these are one of the most fun ones from what people told us who listened to the podcast. Thank you so much for the feedback. It is, a fun series. So essentially, if you are new to this, first of all, go check out the other episodes. But also what we are doing is that we are essentially doing some cheap-ass therapy for ourselves.
It's our totally free version.
Yeah. By revisiting movies that scared us when we were kids because we were either way too young to watch it or for some reason it had an impression on us in some kind of way. And we kind of like try to dissect to see why the fuck was this so scary to us back in the days. And also kind of answer the question, is it still scary today?
Mm-hmm.
And today we are revisiting a movie for Megan,
Woo!
Which I have absolutely no idea why you found that creepy or
Shut
scary
the fuck
or whatever.
I'm going to explain myself.
Well, that's exactly why we're here. I want to understand and know about it.
I'm hoping I can explain myself to the degree that you will understand perfectly because we've known each other for long enough now.
Sure.
And
but also
the general audience listening to this will also have a good idea as to what I'm talking
about.
Yeah,
that's the important part.
For some reason or another.
Yes. So today we are revisiting the original 1997 I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Hey-o. It's a classic. Come on, it is. No,
okay.
It is.
Okay, Gru.
Shut up. For people our age, I think
it
this,
is. A, no, I 100%
this is just
agree.
One of those. This is the one of those films that was right in the wake of Scream, and when we had that whole resurgence of like the meta slasher type
exactly.
whole thing that like the Scream franchise kind of set off for us.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So,
yeah.
What I want to do to start this off is that obviously. I'm pretty sure that probably 99% of the people have seen this movie. If you haven't, what the hell are you doing with your life? Go watch it right now.
Okay, literally pause and go watch it and come back. Yeah.
Yeah. But what I want to do is, you know, we're not going to go through kind of like the whole beats and plots of the movie and whatever it is. We'll do for the important things to mention of the why this traumatized you, obviously.
Yeah.
But I want to kind of like set the stage a little bit and talk about some of the background, production, and fun movie facts about the movie for a bit.
Yeah.
Right? To kind of set the stage here. Okay, so essentially, this movie hit the theaters in October 17th, 1977. 1997, not 77, my bad. Less than a year after Kevin Williamson's Scream cracked open the slasher market. He's also the same guy who
wrote the screenplay for this film.
Exactly.
Correct.
That's it. So the budget was only $17 million, and it made $125 worldwide.
Damn, guys.
Which is 7.4 times its budget, which is like super successful.
You
know what I mean?
You can tell what Scream had done for the market.
Oh, yeah.
At that time, that anything in its wake coming out that had any vague similarity of like a teen slasher was going to go through the fucking roof for box office.
Yeah, exactly. But you know what? There's some story behind this because it's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So 7.4 times the budget is like super success.
Yeah.
I think nowadays 2.5 is good. A 3 is very good.
Oh my
you know?
God, yeah.
So it held the number one spot for 3 consecutive weekends, including the Halloween weekend, which is, you know, pretty big.
It came out in October. That was a clever release.
I know.
Although
yeah.
you'd think this feels like a summer release film.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it also beat the Devil's Advocate movie, which was opening around the same time.
That's a Keanu movie, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. I love that movie. So, of course, it was adapted from the 1973 YA suspense novel written by Lewis Duncan, which had the same name.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to go over it, but it was very, very similar. You know, it was just set in a different place, New Mexico in this place. It was four teens who hit a boy on a bicycle on a mountain, covering it up. And then there was absolutely nobody dies, essentially. There was no death.
No. It's,
so it was
it's
like,
more of an exploration of the trauma and the PTSD that they deal with from it. And Lois Duncan was not a fan
she was,
of this
movie. Yeah, appalled by it and everything. But yeah, so what happened with this is that when he wrote the screenplay, Kevin Williamson here, so he wrote this screenplay before Scream.
Oh, did he actually?
Actually, yeah. Mm. But the problem is that no one wanted to buy it for some reason, right? So he tried to get it greenlit. It failed. But after Scream was very successful at $170
million,
Columbia reversed its decision basically overnight and was like, yeah, fucking do it.
You
kind of have something on your plate here, you know? So the changes that he's done was kind of like heavily inspired by his father and grandfather who were commercial fishermen. So, you know, that's kind of where the fishing town comes from, the whole hook and everything and blah, blah.
Yeah.
So fun things about the movie is that, and also kind of very surprising, is that the whole cast is basically literally built from secondary choices.
Really?
Yeah.
I can't even imagine this with other people.
It's absolutely, I know,
this
right?
Feels
it's
like
absolutely
they're
so insane.
Iconically cemented in these roles that I'm like, oh, no.
I know, yeah, because they started, like, it basically spawned a whole classic thing here that we're just talking about.
Yeah.
Okay, so listen to this. Okay. So Julie James, played by Jennifer Love Hewitt,
yes.
right, was initially supposed to be played by Reese Witherspoon.
Oh,
she was the initial offer, but then she passed after a meeting because she was like, yeah, that's not for me. It's
okay.
weird. And Hewitt originally auditioned actually for Helen.
Oh, did she? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
But she stopped mid-read and she was like, nah.
I don't think this is
going to
work for me.
I don't think I can do it. And then she switched after like 10 minutes. So
do you know who can do it? Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Yeah. That's it. Barry William Cox, played by Ryan Phillippe. Mm-hmm. So after Reese Witherspoon's, after she passed on this whole thing, the director asked her, like, who is the hottest guy that you know? And I think at the time, if my research is correct, she was dating Ryan Phillippe, and she was like, well, my boyfriend, hello.
Oh, were
and
they already dating at
I
the
think
time?
So. Yeah, yeah.
Cruel Intentions came out, like, a couple of years after this.
Okay, so apparently, yeah, that was the case. So, you know, and they were like, okay, I guess he's going to be the guy now.
Okay.
So, Helen Shivers, which is funny because...
The best fucking name.
Yeah, but you know why it happened?
No.
Because in the original novel or city or whatever it is, the name was something Rivers, and they just changed it to Shivers.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Obviously played by Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Yeah.
So she was literally cast 2 weeks before the shooting began because Wilmington. So she was flown to Wilmington after Williamson. Sorry, confusing names.
Yes.
Was sold on her by literally the unreleased pilot of Buffy.
Of Buffy. Yep. Because Buffy premiered that same year, from what I remember.
Exactly.
That's crazy. And she also had a bit part in Scream 2.
Yeah.
The same year.
Well, there you go.
She had a good year in 1997.
And that's it. Ray Bronson, who was played by Freddie Prinze Jr., obviously, initially, the role was supposed to go to Jeremy Sisto.
Huh. He would have been off the back of that Clueless fame at that point, so.
There you go.
Yeah.
So Prince previously lost the Billy Loomis role in Scream to Skeet Ulrich.
Oh, shit. Okay, see, no. I need my Skeet Ulrich.
Oh,
to
I know.
Play
100%.
Billy
I agree.
Nobody else is going to do that for
he
me.
He also apparently auditioned 4 or 5 times. He, like, cut his hair. He bulked up between the auditions to kind of, like, you know, get a different character and whatever it is. So that was very interesting. But also funny enough is that he almost quit the production when a stunt went wrong on a boat.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so that's kind of fucked up.
Oh,
but
no,
anyways,
for
I know.
Him. Oh, well, it's a good thing he didn't because he met his literal wife on this movie.
I know. So that's what I was going to say, right? Is that, like, yes, they met and there was the whole thing and blah, blah, and whatever it is. Funny enough, the guy who plays Fisherman and Jennifer Love Hewitt were neighbors in the same Burbank apartment before filming. Isn't that fucking
that's
crazy?
So weird.
Yeah, they used to, like, chat by the pool.
Oh, that's so cute.
Apparently. So that's funny, you know? So in terms of the filming, the production stuff, right? So the principal photography began March 30th in early June in 97, which lasted about 10 weeks, and 7 of them were done at night because a lot of this movie doesn't happen at night. You know what I mean? Of course, there's a bunch of exteriors that were shot in the little town of Southport, North Carolina. And it's funny because we were talking about that gym. What the fuck was that gym? It's metal containers,
like,
basically.
Is this a shipping container that was converted into
a
gym?
No, it was a cafe called Fishy Fishy Cafe.
That's so cute.
Yep. So, of course, obviously, like I said, you know, they reused a bunch of...
locations that
from the thing. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But the iconic, I guess at this point, the kind of iconic because it has really cool music, opening sequence scene.
Yes.
Not North Carolina.
Oh, where was it?
California.
Oh, okay. Got that cliffside going on. Makes sense.
Yeah, that's it. And the highway that it's shot on, it was in Sonoma County.
Okay.
Which fans call it now the Reaper's Curve. That's a cool name.
Oh, well then.
Also funny enough, the art department literally bought a boat in town, you know, the boat on the beach where they're kind of like drinking, whatever it is. They cut it in half and just planted it in the fucking sand. How crazy is this?
This shit that you used to do back in the day.
I know,
just,
right?
Like, make a set.
Also, funny thing, or not funny, but like actually a cool production thing here is that the chase scene that almost didn't happen. So there was a first Steadicam operator's footage basically became unusable. So the director had to fly in Larry McConkey, the man who shot the famous Copacabana tracking shot in Goodfellas to reshoot.
Oh, wow.
With the exterior, the delay forced the interior to be redressed with plastic-wrapped mannequins. which spun the whole iconic jump scare scene with the fisherman hiding motionless under the dummies.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and it was kind of like a blessing in disguise because that made a whole thing, you know, kind of like what it is now. Mm-hmm. So that's really cool. Also, Sarah Michelle Gellar got like 100 splinters in her hand during the rope scene.
Oh my God.
Which really sucks. So they had to kind of like wrap her hands in rubber and silk, poor essentially. Her. Yeah. That's it. It's fucked up. Also, funny enough, the script kept changing after they wrapped. So we were talking about the whole character of Johnny Galecki, character Max.
Yeah,
so he wasn't supposed to die.
Oh, okay.
But like you said, when we were watching it, is that like nothing really made sense. Why is he there? Max's kind of like whatever.
Max's character is one of the many red herrings that they attempted in this film to like throw you, quote unquote, throw you off of what was actually going on. He's your first one that you get, right? Yeah. So you're like, oh, it's Max. It's Max who like saw what they did. And now he's like doing this because he thinks they're all shit bags, basically. Mm-hmm. And he's not wrong. But like, it's all of that. But of course, like Johnny Galecki, weirdly enough, would have been pretty well known in this cast at the time because of Roseanne. So they couldn't just have him fucking be there and then not do anything with his character.
Yeah, so I don't know if the original script was supposed to have him do something or whatever it is, but in the original script, he survived as a red herring.
Interesting.
And then they kind of like brought him back to reshoot the Crab Factory murder scene.
I mean, yeah, because like it's stupid for plot purposes because there's no reason for the fisherman to kill Johnny. For him to kill Max. Yeah. There's no reason for him to die.
Yeah, but also the problem with that is that the kind of one of the reasons that they did it that is that it created a kind of like a lapse in the movie progression because without his death, during the test screening, there's 35 minutes since the accident where literally nothing happens.
And nobody dies.
Like not much is going on. So it's kind of like it's a pacing issue. You know what I mean?
Fair.
So... Also, I mean, kind of like, you know, the ending thing. We all know what the ending is. That was not the original ending. The original ending was actually fucking lame, and it was shot on purpose by the director because he literally shot it really flatly on purpose because he thought that the studio was going to demand them to reshoot it, which they did. So the original ending, Julie literally just opens her laptop, and it says, "I still know" in an email.
Ew.
Exactly. That's fucking lame.
Especially in 1997, people would have been like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's terrible.
That's what would happen now.
Yeah, exactly. So then they reshot, obviously, the usual, the current ending where, you know, it's still written in the shower.
Yes.
Mirror in the fog, and he kind of like jumps out of it and whatever it is. Yeah, that's it.
At the 11th hour. That's the retconned in the second movie when they're like, it was a dream.
Yeah, that's it. So, I mean, look, there's a bunch of other stuff. I want to get into the actual episode because the rest is not really all that important, I would say. One last funny thing is that apparently the critical reception was pretty bad of this movie, surprisingly. Robert Ebert gave it 1 star, which I'm not surprised. Like anything that is not an Oscar movie, it's bad rating. Yeah, don't care. Yeah. Rotten Tomatoes settled at 47, which is kind of surprising, you know?
Okay. I mean, don't get me wrong. I get it.
I get fine, yeah.
We were talking about it during the movie. You at some point were like, how long is this movie?
Yeah, I know.
Feels longer than it is.
The only critics that actually liked it was Washington Post Harrington's, who called it superior to Scream.
So. Okay. Whoa.
Yeah, I know. Okay, whoa, chill there.
Bold,
but
calm down.
Yeah, exactly. So here is, you know, your cool movie facts.
Okay.
Because, you know, you've seen all the movie about it already. So now you get a cool background. And now I actually want to understand because when we started recording this, even before we started, you didn't tell me why.
No.
So I'm coming in blind to what the fuck. It makes no sense to me. So I really want to understand.
Okay. So I'm going to set the scene for you.
Sure.
I'm going to read the IMDb synopses.
If you're going to tell me you used to live in a fisherman's town, I'm not believing
you. Shut the fuck up. You know I didn't. Okay, I'm going to read the IMDb synopsis and then I'm going to set the scene for you as to what this is and what happened when I watched this film the first time. So, IMDb synopsis. 4 young friends bound by a tragic accident are reunited when they find themselves being stalked by a hook-wielding maniac in their small seaside town.
Such a better IMDb synopsis than some of the recent ones that we've read.
Well, it's because people actually had time to watch this movie because IMDb didn't exist when this film came out.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah. All right. And everybody, smart. Anybody who works there would have seen it. So. okay. So, I set scene. So, when this film came out in 1997,
yes,
I would have been 8 years old when this movie came out. Now, I did not go see the movie in theaters probably because I wouldn't have been allowed to. I have a cool mom who, you know, introduced me to a lot of horror when I was younger, but she wouldn't have been cool enough to take me to see this movie.
Okay.
I remember wanting to go see it, and she was like, Megan, they're not going to let us go in and see that. And then we did not. But then I had it in my mind, and it got stuck in there. So then, like, the 6, 7, 8 months later, when it came out on video for rental, as soon as it popped up at the video store, I was like, I want to watch this movie. And so I would have been like 9-ish at this point.
Right.
Here's my mom going, are you sure? Are you sure you want to watch this? Yes, 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 yes. I can't wait. I want to see this. I want to see this. I want to see this. Now, keep in mind, too, at this point, we were like a year into Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and I was obsessed.
Oh, right. Of course.
With that show. And like Party of Five had been on, and Jennifer Love Hewitt had been in Party of Five. Like, I knew the faces, I knew the people. So I had that familiarity, and I wanted to watch this movie so badly. The year that the movie came out on video, we moved in to a house for the first time. This was the first time that I'd ever like existed in a space that was as large as this was. And it was an older house that we moved into. It was built in the 60s. And so it was like a smaller bungalow, but it was creaky, you know, like it had that kind of like older quality to it. And, I don't know if you remember this, because when we met, I lived in this house when you and
I
remember. Met,
I lived in this house. I know.
So when, especially when we moved in, the furnace in the basement at the time would come on and be very loud and make like a lot of noise. And it had a tendency to do that multiple times throughout the day. And I wasn't used to living in a space like this, where when you're walking on different floors, you can hear people because it's like creaky, or there are like noises that you're not used to. And so my 9-year-old self, my parents rented this movie, but neither of them were particularly interested in seeing it. So I was sitting by myself in the basement watching the film play out.
Okay.
And when the sequence of events rolls around where Helen's character, Sarah Michelle Gellar, is being chased through her family store, and her sister is killed by the fisherman, and he's dragging her on the hook through the building. There was noise in the house that I wasn't used to. We were in an unfamiliar place. We'd barely been there for a few months at the time. I was fucking terrified. And my mom had to stop the video.
No way.
Yeah, and I couldn't watch it for like 2 years after.
Wow.
So I didn't actually know what the ending of the film
was for
a couple years
that
after.
Long? Fuck.
Yeah. And by the time I watched it again, I was like, what the hell is wrong with me? I would have been like 11 maybe at that point. And I was what is the matter with me? Why did I ever think that this was scary? But I have a core memory of sitting by myself in my basement with covers like pulled up to my eyeballs. And my mom comes back downstairs. She's like, oh, Jesus Christ. Okay, I'm pressing stop on this. Like, you're fucking terrified, obviously. So she had to like do that and calm me down.
Wow. Okay. I didn't know it was that bad. I mean, you know what? Kind of like the whole atmosphere of it makes sense.
I have to set the actual scene. And if you've ever lived in a creaky ass old house and you've had things that just randomly, the cat's having a moment. And you've ever just lived in a scary ass old house and it just makes noise.
Yeah.
You know, there's just random shit in your house that makes noise at night. You will understand what I'm talking about. And I'm sure that you might have memories to that degree as well. So there you go. Okay. Let's get into overarching plot. Because the thing is, without getting into like too many specifics, I feel like if you're here, you've seen the movie. But without getting into too many specifics, we can chat through some of the overall plot points themselves and also get into it, because I feel like this is the type of film, it came after Scream, but the thing with Scream is that there was a much more sort of, there were fewer red herrings. There was a much more sort of straightforward and linear kind of storyline to Scream that works in its favor, whereas this film, it was almost like Kevin Williamson took it and they wanted him to add even more red herrings and little fake outs here and there, but it winds up making kind of a confusing plot where if you're not paying attention, you're kind of like, wait, why are there certain characters in this? What the fuck actually happened? Who is the fisherman and why is he killing people in the first place? There is a reason for it.
Yeah.
But you don't, if you're not paying attention, you don't know what it is.
I mean, look, like I said at the beginning, he did write it before Scream. Mm-hmm. So, of course, then Scream came out and, you know, they when probably they wanted to kind of like rejig it and stuff. Yeah, exactly. So that's probably what happened and it makes sense. And probably. There was also a bunch of changes post movie being wrapped. So
exactly what you said. There were reshoots and everything as well. So,
yeah.
So, yeah, at its core, obviously, you follow the four friends who have just graduated. It's their last summer before they all go off to college, et cetera, except Ray, who I don't think got into college. He's going to New York. I don't know.
Unclear. Well, he said he wanted to go to New York.
Yeah. Anyway, I guess he's going to be attending college there. Whatever. Jennifer Love Hewitt's like our lead. She's our final girl who plays Julie. Julie's going off to law school in Boston. I can only assume she's going to Harvard or somewhere, you know.
Sure.
Pretty good, I guess. There's, you know, some stuff to do with like people splitting up and things like that. Now the cat has settled and now he's exhausted himself. There's going to be so many scritchy noises in the back of this episode. Okay, sorry. I'm distracted by him. Anyway, they are having like a last hurrah of sorts. This is a small fishing town. Helen is like doing like the beauty pageant thing and stuff there and winning like their version
of it. Okay, right. Oh my God, I remember this. So when we were watching the fish girl.
Whatever she is.
It's the Kroger thing. The fish girl. What the fuck? Okay, so when we're watching this, because you know I've seen this movie multiple times. I found it absolutely fucking hilarious that the first lines of the main characters, because I don't count the guy who's like presenting the girls at the beauty pageant there, whatever, is literally one of the characters goes, oh, wow, your girlfriend has really big tits.
Yeah,
that's in different basically it. Words, yes. But you know, that's what it was.
It's just like I didn't realize that they were so ample. And I'm like, oh my God, that's Freddie Prinze Jr.'s first
line. That is the first line of the main characters.
Also, I would just like to say hilarious. That it's the first line that his character has.
Yeah.
And he's talking about his wife. That's funny.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's true.
Another fun little fact. I'm going to throw in some fun facts, too. Yeah,
that's right. I did my fun facts.
Aha, well, I have some, too. Another fun little fact is that, of course, that's it. This is the movie in which Sarah Michelle Gellar and Freddie Prinze Jr. met one another. And then from there would go on. They became friends, but from there would go on to obviously fall in love and get married. And they're married to this day.
Oh, yeah. The whole thing was that...
They don't exchange lines with each other's characters throughout the entire film.
Oh, wow.
They don't have a line that's directed... At the care at between the two of them, no, not once.
That's fucking weird.
Isn't it funny?
That's really weird.
It's just yep. No, they don't at all. Huh. Not one time.
They're
do they directly speak to each other?
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyways, that whole scene is all fucking bizarre because I don't think I've ever said hey to any of my friends.
Yeah,
your girlfriend has big
your
tits.
Your girlfriend's got some pretty big tits. Yeah. It's a really interesting thing to say to your friend. Although this group gives off like frenemy vibes to a degree.
Yeah.
Like Helen and Julie, not quite as much. They actually seem like they like each other. But Barry and Ray, you guys are just the boyfriends who happen to be
right
around each other on a regular basis. They do not seem like they're friends to me. Because Barry's a dick.
Yeah.
And Ray
they're
is,
all kind of very dicky.
And Ray is like jealous and resentful in general of people's status that he does not have. So... Anyway, so obviously they go on a joyridey drive type of thing. Barry's acting like a douchebag. He's Ray's driving because he was like, hey, you're fucking wasted, so you can't drive this car, which makes sense. And of course, but of course, Barry being a fucking dumbass sticks his head out the skylight or the sunroof. Oops. And... then distracts Ray and drops the bottle of bourbon or whatever that he's drinking.
I think that was scotch.
Okay, it was scotch or bourbon. I have no idea. I assume because it's like an American film that it's bourbon, whatever.
I'm pretty sure it was scotch.
Sure.
I would need to rewatch that. Okay. I'm pretty sure I even know which one it was.
Can you tell he likes scotch?
Whatever, man.
Anyway, he is acting like an idiot. He fucking drops the half bottle that he's got of liquor into the vehicle, distracts Ray to the point that he does not see that there's a person who stumbled into the middle of the road, and they hit him. La-di-da. This is a person in, that's it, like, full fucking fisherman garb.
No, he wasn't yet.
Yes, he was. Nope.
He was wearing, like, jeans and a shirt.
He had the rubber boots.
He did have the rubber boots, yes.
I thought he had the slicker.
No, 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 he didn't. Because you can still see his face, and they're like, oh my God, his face is all fucked up.
Okay, I thought he had the slicker on, but not the... Oh, fuck, you're right.
No, 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 he was just like wearing normal... I thought
he had the slicker on, but not the hat, anyway.
No, he looks basically kind of what he was wearing at the end of the movie. It's yes, jeans and the thing, yeah.
Yes.
That's it.
So,
and then, you know, they kind of hit the guy, and they're all like, oh my God, what are we going to do and everything? Yeah. And they panic, and they decide to dump his body into a local marina.
And the only person whose argument in this case makes sense is maybe Ray's, because he does not have rich parents who can pay to get him out of jail if he's arrested.
Yeah.
So I can kind of understand his motivation. But yeah, Barry being like, they're going to think I was driving the car and stuff. I'm like, no, why?
Yeah, just because it's his car.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. No. He has literally blood on his face and the windshield is not bashed in. It makes no logical sense of he would be driving the car.
Ray is completely unscathed. So, you're like, so obviously it's very easy for you to indicate he was the DD and he's driving. I don't understand.
The DD?
Designated driver.
Okay. The fuck?
What? It's a thing. Okay. Sorry, he's foreign, so he doesn't really... understand what, these shortened versions of words
Anyways, they dumped the body, and of course the guy is not dead. You know, there's that whole iconic scene where...
They're in the water.
What's his face there? Goes to jump after Barry. Goes to jump after the crown. Well, because
they're going to dump him in the water, and he fucking wakes up, and they push him into the water. Anyway, that's fully murder now.
Oh, yeah.
This isn't... I'm trying to cover up...
Yeah, it
translated from... The vehicular manslaughter accident that we're trying to cover up. Now this is full fucking murder. Oh, no, he's woken up. We should drown him. Jesus Christ, guys. My God. Yeah, they push him into the water, but he grabs Helen's tiara that she's just worn at the pageant. It. So, of course, Barry jumps in to go get it because it's evidence.
Yeah, there's that whole scene and everything. And then, you know, a year later happens.
Yes.
And Julie receives a very nicely handwritten note. I keep thinking about it.
She's fully in her emo phase at this point because she's all PTSD and shit.
She's
stringy bangs. That's how you can tell.
Okay. whatever. She gets a note with a very nice handwritten text, which I keep finding that is really nicely real. Yeah. He was like putting effort into this.
Mm-hmm.
That says, I know what you did last summer.
Dum, dum, dum. Where's that little gif of the little hamster?
And then that's when the whole kind of like situation ensues. And
correct.
Panic. And
when it becomes your slasher whodunit. So,
yeah.
Oh God, who was there? Who knows that this happened with us outside of the group of the four of us? And so that's where what I was mentioning earlier happens, right? You've got all your stupid red herrings that happen. So first is Max, Johnny Galecki's character, who is another guy who works like at the docks with Ray. He like works.
Yeah,
on, like,
and
the
he saw them on the road.
Yeah, and he has a thing for Julie.
Yeah,
but obviously she's with Ray, so she's not interested. He's weird. He's weird with his persistence of like hanging out with her. I'm like, dude, she like fully has a fucking boyfriend. Like maybe tone it down a little bit, because he doesn't even act like, oh no, just his friends or whatever. No, he's fully like, I want to take you out. I want to do this. I'm like, oh, this is weirdly written. Anyway. His character is your red herring, or like, oh, maybe because Max came across us that same night, he saw something and he's doing this now to like fuck with us because he doesn't like us or whatever. And then what's discovered is that what Julie found out in the interim of this year that's gone by is that this young man named David Egan died, allegedly, the same night that they hit this person on the road who they didn't know who this person was. So they're like, oh, it's this, it must be this guy,
David
Egan.
They think it's him.
He was found in the water weeks later, and this must be the person that we hit. It was ruled an accidental drowning, which also is weird because he was super bashed around from that car.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as well. I'm like, eh.
But whatever. So they think this is the person that they've hit. And so, of course, they start looking into it. And, you know, Julie finds out, okay, he's survived by a sister, Melissa. So they, her and Helen drive out to speak with Melissa to try and get an idea of, like, who David was and why the fuck he was out there in the middle of the fucking night in the first place. Melissa's played by Anne Heche, who, like, RIP, she passed away in 2022, unfortunately. She had, like, a lot of pretty iconic roles. She was, like, famously in the remake of Psycho in the late 90s as well. That would have been a year or two after this film came out, as well as, like, a few other things. Yeah. So, yeah, unfortunately, she had passed away after a pretty severe car wreck. It was, like, very famously very messy a few years ago. So, anyway, She plays the sister, Missy, who is, like, out in the sticks and is another fucking red herring because she's quote-unquote weird, right? Because she's, like, a weird country bumpkin type.
Yeah, she's weird. She has, like, a knife and she skins animals.
She hunts, I assume.
Yeah, that's
and
it.
And then just, like, you know, deals with, like, the fowl and the poultry that she's hunting. It's turkeys and stuff.
Whatever, it doesn't matter.
No, literally it does not matter, but it gives you so much expository dialogue that you're like, okay. So what they find out from Missy and from reading articles is that this man, David Egan, a year prior to when they allegedly hit him with their car, he was in a car accident with his fiance at the time. She was killed. He was uninjured. So he had been carrying a ton of guilt with him for like the past year. And in the first shot of the film, we see him. David,
yeah,
but we don't know that it's David.
Mountain.
He's sitting on the cliffside. He's drunk.
Super depressed and everything. Yeah.
He's drunk. He's depressed. He's holding what I can only assume is a necklace that belonged to his fiance who was killed. And then but you don't know who that is. And so it doesn't make sense the first time you watch the film because you're like, who the fuck is this guy now?
Yeah, seriously, first time I watched this film, I completely forgot this scene existed.
Exactly.
Because it never comes back.
And nothing happens to
him. All the way until the end.
Nothing happens to him on screen.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, they're trying to suss this out and they're like, okay, so, you know, he was out there, he was feeling guilty, he was revisiting the spot where his fiance died, et cetera, et cetera. We accidentally hit him with our car and now he is, I guess because he didn't die, he's enacting revenge, quote unquote. And so that's the assumption that they're going with. So we get, or it's like, oh, we actually did kill him. He died in the water, but now like his sister found out about it and she's doing it. So like first it's Max, but then we see Max be killed by the fisherman. Then it's the sister Missy, but that also seems a little bit funky or just kind of like, what the fuck? And then it does come to pass later on that like it's incredibly clear that that's not the case at all and that Missy is not aware of any of the things that have happened and that David genuinely, well, it's, to be fair, he did not die by suicide. That is the assumption that happens. They called it an accidental drowning. She's sure that he decided to end his life. However, that's also not the case. He was killed by the actual fisherman killer character, which is why that person, who we find out later is someone else, was out on the highway that night because David was sitting on the edge of the cliff and was pushed and killed by the
actual killer. Okay, see, that's fucking convoluted.
But you don't, it doesn't make sense. You don't know. And you're just kind of like, and you're, you know, you're watching it and you're like, wait, fuck, hang on. This is what I'm talking about. This is
like a fucking puzzle you have to solve.
Yeah, this is what I'm talking about. This is why whoever the hell wrote for like the Washington Post or whatever who said that this was superior to Scream is insane. They're on another fucking planet because Scream, you can follow the sequence of events. It's explained to you. It makes sense. You're like, okay, I see how we got here. I see why we're here. Yes, we've got our red herrings. We've got our characters who are like our quote unquote fake outs to a degree.
Yeah.
And then one of them who you thought was a red herring actually turns out to be one of the killers. Like all that stuff, like with Billy, like you back and forth about him and everything. All of that makes sense. This, you have to like follow. You have to pay attention to be like, okay, wait, so hang on. So the guy that we randomly see in the opening of the film
think,
is this.
Well, and maybe that's why they said that this is superior to Scream because it's not that in your face.
But
you know what I mean? You have to like think about
it. I don't think it's like strong enough of a script for it
to
be considered
I get
better,
it.
If that makes sense. Anyway, whatever. So that turns out to actually be what the case is. So, of course, what the actual sequence of events is that the woman who was David Egan's fiance who was killed, David is killed the year prior by her father, Ben Willis, who is enacting revenge because he thinks that David, he basically blames David for his daughter's death.
Right, yeah.
Right. So he follows David out to the cliffs where he is, like I said, inebriated and sitting on the edge of the cliff. I assume pushes him, so he dies.
Whatever, doesn't matter.
Right?
We don't know.
And then on his way back, is hit by the car that the four main characters are driving, essentially. And however, as we see, doesn't die, technically. And even after he's pushed into the water, you know, there's that assumption that he's drowned. That's not true. He obviously
makes it
through.
No, we see him wake up.
And then, of course, that's it begins to enact his entire plan of revenge a year later. So when all of four of them have returned to the town of Southport, he decides to enact his plan for revenge.
Yo,
that's
man,
what the actual
you gotta have
is.
Notes while you're watching this movie because, like, you gotta write
shit
down.
Yeah. So that's what happens. And then, of course, in typical slasher format, he quote-unquote slowly makes his way through the group, essentially, and adds a couple of other kills onto there, too, so that you up the body count.
Yeah, of course.
That's really what it is. That's why Max dies, because there's no reason for Max to die.
Well, there is because, you know, it's a rewrite thing.
Exactly. No, but it's also, again, that's what I mean. It's to up the body count in the film so that it's more of a slasher, right? So that's why Max dies. That is why... later on during the sequence, so Barry's killed eventually by the fisherman or Ben at some point during the new like pageant that's occurring. He's killed. And then afterwards, not too long after that, the same evening, Helen is eventually stalked and killed by the killer. But there's the entire sequence where she runs to her family's sort of like mini department store that they have in town, and her like really cranky older sister, Elsa, who's like fucking mean to her, which I'm like, whoa, like the animosity between these sisters is like really fucking intense for some reason, is also killed, which again is kind of for no reason to a degree. Again, Elsa's just there to up the body count as well.
I mean, yeah, because you can't, I feel like you can't not kill her and then go kill the other one in the same
space, I think that's whatever. What it is, because they're in the same space and he's sneaking in anyway. Of course. Just going to kill the sister because she's there. Side note, Elsa's played by Bridget Wilson, who I think a year or two prior to this had been Sonya Blade in the Mortal Kombat movie.
Nice.
Yeah, because I was like, because I remember we were watching it and I was like, why does she look really familiar? That's why. Yeah.
That's legit.
Yeah.
And then he also becomes like super sneaky and somehow sneaks a bunch of crabs
into
the trunk.
Thank you very much. With Max's body. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Fuck. Thank you for bringing this up. Can we talk about the some superpower that Ben Willis seems to have? This is like in the Friday the 13th movies where eventually Jason's like a zombie and he can teleport to different places, which I'm pretty sure is canon. I don't care what anybody says. I'm pretty sure that's canon. Where Ben has this uncanny ability to set up a murder scene and then clean it to the point that you cannot find evidence of it after. What the fuck was up with Julie's trunk?
Yeah.
It is spotless. And 5 minutes before that, there was a dead body and there were and like crabs. Numerous crabs crawling on it in the trunk. What just, the fuck? How is
he's
that
a
possible?
Fisherman. He knows what he's doing. Okay. Very skilled fisherman.
It doesn't make sense.
He, imagine the effort that he had to go through. He had to fish those crabs and then fucking put it in the trunk with a body.
It's so stupid.
I applaud this man. Good job, Ben.
Good job, Ben Willis.
You're doing good shit.
I don't know. But I have questions for, I think it's Jim Gillespie is the director of the film. Sure. He's a Scottish director. He's not done like a ton of other stuff. But Jennifer Love Hewitt has cited him as one of her favorite directors that she has ever worked with. She really, really loved working with him. Jim, come on.
That's cool.
Come on the podcast. You can come and talk to us about the movie. That would be great.
Jesus Christ.
What?
Okay.
Half my family is Scottish. I feel like we have things in common.
All right. That's going to be the selling point.
Hey,
Megan's half Scottish. Coming to the podcast.
And my family's also from Glasgow, which I'm pretty sure is where he's from. So. anyway, yeah. So none of that makes any sense. But that happens. So that's it. First, Max is killed. Elsa's killed at the store. Sorry, I should say Barry is killed first at the pageant. Elsa is killed at the store. And then Helen, in trying to escape, has her whole like rigmarole scene where she pretty good, like I would say a pretty solid chase sequence with the killer that she goes through where she almost makes it out into the crowd. And then because like, for plot purposes, they have her pause.
That's fucking annoying, man.
Oh, I know. I don't like it. And it makes me mad because I'm like, oh, no. You can't have Sarah Michelle Gellar die that way.
She could have just, like, tripped her or some shit. She doesn't need to pause to get that kind of, like, jump scare when she turns around and he's right behind her. Come on.
No, it was annoying. I didn't really love that very much. But it, and I remember as a kid, even when I watched the entire film the whole way through, it made me sad because I was like, oh, like, she literally could have made it.
Yeah, I know.
So I kind of hated that.
Yeah.
And then this leads obviously all to the final sort of confrontation with Ben's character where we mostly get an explanation. This is me just like I've had to like look into it to infer properly happened. Because really when you listen to the dialogue in the film, you also can't quite figure out why Ben killed David. You're like, wait, hang on. What is your relation to this person and why were you there in the first place and all this kind of weird shit? Anyway, They wind up on a boat because, of course, the last red herring of the film is that it's
Rey. Oh, it's right. That's it's it. Yes, Rey, of course.
Which I will say, in now, I guess, rewatching this movie now with new eyes, having seen the requel that came out last right. year, is kind of fun to an extent. Like, it's a fun little thing because, spoilers, if you've not seen it.
Okay, wow.
Rey is the killer in the new one, right? So, oh, yeah. He's the one who's like orchestrated everything.
Well, I guess happening. That's kind of a smart way of.
Yeah. So it's kind of a fun, I guess, like full circle moment for the series, right? Like, is it kind of weird? Yeah. But also, like, it's kind of fun that they do this. And I think I'd forgotten in this original one how much they try to, like, be like, oh, but Rey's a fisherman. He could be. Okay. But doing
that
was
like
it.
The only reason they were trying to push it towards him is that to be like, oh, yeah, but you have a slicker. And you have a, what is it called? A gaff? The hook there?
Yeah, the hook. The gaff. You're like,
I think that's what it's called.
Is it? Is that what the actual like term for it is? I don't remember.
I'm pretty sure.
I don't know. Anyway, I believe you. You're going to want to go fact check
it. You go fact check it. I know my shit.
I don't care.
So yeah, and they're like, you know, oh yeah, you own a rain boot, so you must be the killer. It's like, kind of ridiculous. Every time they're trying to point fingers at him, I'm like, come on. Okay. Like, literally during the parade scene, you said, why is there so many people who are wearing fucking, what's it called? The rain suit.
Yes, the slicker. And the slicker whole, thing and the hat
at the parade in like, the middle of summer.
It's the 4th of July.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't make any sense. So no. I'm like, okay, hello. There's probably another 100 of him. And just because he's it's a fishing town. Hello.
Yeah.
Anyways, you know what I mean?
No, it's traditionally called a J hook because it's shaped like a J. You're incorrect. Anyway, he's going to look it up. Anyway, so this all leads to the final confrontation in which we quote unquote learn what Ben's motivation was for this, even though honestly, you literally have to look it up to understand what the entire plot of this film is. There is an entire chase sequence through the ship, which was cool. I like the chase sequence through the boat. How do you feel about the chase sequence through the boat?
Okay, so the gaff is a handheld pole with a sharp hook or a sideways spike on a distal end. Usually they're a little bit longer, but you can also have a very short version of it. So I am correct.
Can you answer my question?
What was your question? I was fucking looking for information.
Do you like the final chase sequence through the boat? I think this movie has some pretty solid chase sequences. The whole thing through the shop and everything with Helen, I think is good. And then the final chase sequence like through the boat with Julie and Rey, I think is pretty solid.
I think that was pretty good, yes, because mainly it wasn't dumb. Mm. You know what I mean? And yes, there's different ways to go about it, but the killer is also a fisherman, so he kind of knows his way around his own vessel.
Of course.
You know, which is smart. The only thing that kind of like irked me is that when Rey comes back onto the boat because he's thrown off the boat, mm-hmm. He has to climb all the way on the mast for some reason.
I have no idea why he did that.
That was literally to like prevent Julie from being killed by the hook guy.
Yeah, because he swings the hook.
The hook or the crane, whatever it is. Yeah, that's it. And I'm like, okay, you just held on in a boat that's moving in the water. Mm-hmm. You climb that rope. I'm telling you, you're tired. Oh, I've done those rope climbs. You're tired. And you're saying you're going to go all the way onto the mast. That makes absolutely no sense.
This is a super slouchy sweater.
It's
that would be weighing you down.
I know exactly on top of that.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the only thing that kind of was a little bit annoying to me, but otherwise, no, I think it was pretty smart. It's a contained environment and they used a lot of the boat as much as they could. So, you know, it was good and smart.
I thought it was like a cool like set piece.
Yeah.
Kind of to have like the final sort of confrontation be there. And then of course, yeah, obviously that's it. Ben gets caught and is like swung up sort of into like the mast of the ship and his hand is decapitated. The hand with the hook is decapitated. That's so funny. Or it's like,
I don't think you can say decapitated. Okay, sorry.
No, you're right. Sorry. It's severed.
Yeah, my bad. Who's the four now?
It's severed. Sorry. And then he swings into the water, but like not in a way that would kill him. So I love that afterwards the cops are like, I'm sure he's dead and we'll find the body. And I'm like, you don't fucking know that. You could swim with one arm.
Yeah, you could.
Yeah.
Anyway. Also, it is summer. It's not like he's going to have hypothermia
July 4th. And stuff. Literally. Yeah, that's it. And then we get, that's it, our final sequence, which is like a number of months later or whatever it is. Julie's back and is at school and happy and la-di-da. And her and Ray are together raising New York. She's in Boston. And she... go, she has her final sequence that you referenced earlier.
Yeah, the whole thing with the mirror and the shower.
Yeah, the shower, everything super steamed up, and someone has written, "I still know," on the glass of the shower door, and then we get the fake out of the slicker, or the fisherman, I should say, jumping through as like the final jump scare of the film before it cuts to credits. But like I said, that's it. Again, spoilers, but in the second film, which came out like a couple of years later, I think, this is retcon completely because it's just supposed to be a dream.
That's it.
So that we could have a second movie.
You know what's funny is that they literally rushed Scream 2 because of the success of this movie.
Hmm.
Yeah. Isn't that weird?
Well, because Scream 2 came out in 1997 as well, didn't it?
I don't remember, but they rushed it because this one was doing so well and everything that they rushed this movie. I also just want to say that I find it is really funny. All the other sequels that followed.
Yeah.
Number two was not bad. I don't remember number three. And whatever sequel number is.
We have not seen number three.
Okay, fine. And whatever sequel number is when the guy comes back as a zombie.
That's the third one.
That's the third one?
We haven't seen that one.
I'm pretty sure I've seen it.
No, okay. We've just seen bits and bobs of that one, but we've not actually watched.
Okay, that's possible.
Yeah, that's like a totally different one.
Yeah, anyways, it's fucking hilarious because he's like undead. And basically has magic powers or some shit. It's
Well, see, he's zombie insane. Jason.
Yeah, he's zombie Jason.
Yeah. That's literally what it is. Okay, no, you are correct. So it was October, you said, right, of 1997 that this one was released?
Mid-October, yeah.
Scream 2 was released on December 12th of 1997.
Okay, so well, there you go.
2 months later.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that they were in post, and then they were just like, finish it.
Yeah.
Like the minute came out. So, yeah, interesting. Yeah, I don't know. Okay. Let's wrap it up. So final thoughts about this, like what is your overall thought about this film for you now in terms of like the movie as a whole, the cast, whatever it is, like what are your,
I want to talk about your scariness of not watching it. I feel like we skipped over it. You said the scene, it was good. I get it. I am just surprised that, okay. No, actually my question for you is, does it still scare you now, so many years later?
You know what? So, okay,
Or does it still have an impact on you when you watch it because it throws you back into that memory?
Yeah, it's got
and everything. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like it does still have a nostalgia sort of factor to it, I will say, in watching it again. In watching it, the older I get, the more I realize that there are a lot of lulls in the story that happen, which again, to me, just, you know, speaks to how it's not equivalent to Scream, guys. I'm sorry. Anybody who thinks that is crazy. Scream doesn't have any lulls as far as I'm concerned. So, it's just one of those that I have the nostalgia for it. And I think I really enjoy it for what it is, even with those faults and with that, as we've just gone through in more detail, incredibly fucking convoluted plot points.
So complicated, man.
So complicated. Just there's more layer to it than there needed to be for a slasher. It was unnecessary. So I will say that. But I won't say that it has like an effect on me in the same way now, this many years later, because, and I keep saying this, when we go to see movies and we see people in the theater with us, especially new releases, when we go and we have people like screaming at jump scares and different things, I'm like, man, I am a desensitized human being at this point. And I'm not saying that in a way to be like, oh my, nothing scares me, nothing bothers me. No, I'm not saying that to be like an asshole about it. I'm just saying that it's rare that I'm hugely affected by slasher tropes and many of like the slasher scares that we get in a lot of these films are jump scares specifically. They're not necessarily the kind of foreboding sense of dread that you get from more psychological horror or something else, which tends to affect me, I think, a little bit more now because I can feel a sense of dread regardless of how desensitized I am to things.
I feel a sense of dread every fucking day. So
sometimes you're just driving somewhere and you're like, man, people are crazy. So I get it. But So I won't say that it necessarily has the same effect on me, but I will say that, you know what, even just rewatching it, which we just did,
yeah, we before just
we
did
sat
it
down to record
literally an hour ago,
I, you know, it's still got a couple of moments where I'm like, wow, the jump scares in this film are very abrupt. Like they're very in your face. You know, there are at least, I think, two that I can think of, including the ending of the film,
yeah,
where
that one's good.
The jump scare is like very intense, like it's very abrupt, and I could see that it would have been extremely effective at the time that the movie was released as well.
Yeah,
I'm sure you got a lot of jumping in the theater when that happened. So while maybe it doesn't affect me in the same way, I live in the nostalgia for it. I live in the nostalgia largely, I will say, of the type of movie that it was at the time and of the cast. There's some the cast in a movie like this,
I think
is what causes a lot of the nostalgia, because I have a lot of love for the people, particularly in this time period, that were in this film and what they were doing. Because I'm just like I'm a huge Sarah Michelle Gellar fan. I'm like a Jennifer Love Hewitt fan. I still think she's great to this day.
So you get the nostalgia of it more than anything else.
Yeah, so I think more than anything, that's kind of what it does. But in the sense of like, does it affect me in the same way now?
Yeah.
I can have the memory of feeling the way that I felt at the time while not experiencing those emotions now.
Interesting, because the other episode we did that is one of mine, which is Screamers.
Oh God, you and
Screamers. We rewatched it. I mean, look, that movie has way too much fucking political sci-fi stuff, which is probably coming from the book, which is fine.
Everybody does need to listen to the episodes that we've done for Arthur's specific childhood trauma movies.
They're fucking great,
his
man.
His are fascinating. His are so interesting. Mine are like much more mainstream. I grew up in North America, but like mine are much more mainstream. So like I spent just time seeing a lot of these types of films as they were coming out. But you tended to view things like afterwards a little bit later than I did.
Just watching weird movies.
Yeah. And so it was just from such a different lens. So I really want people to listen. They're great. And I know I'm just like plugging our own shit, but like I want people to listen to those episodes because they're just so funny and so insane, because they're all first time watches for me, which is also so fucking fun. Both of the ones that you've done for yourself have been first time watches for me, and they've been so fun. So people should go back and listen to those episodes.
Hey, man. That's great. If it were first time watches for you and they
do it,
had a very interesting impact on me. And then you were like, what the fuck? Why?
They were hilarious.
Yo, this is why I never had stuffies, man. That fucking teddy bear in Screamers. Fuck that.
I think I want to say sometime in the first 3 or 4 years that we were dating, you referenced this movie and you couldn't remember what the name of it was. And you started talking about this movie.
It's still in my head.
And there's some creepy ass fucking teddy bear that's like possessed by an alien or something at the end of the movie.
Not
and
possessed.
I was like, what are you talking about? And then I ignored you completely. And then it wasn't until years
that's
later that you looked it up and actually realized what it was. And you were like, we have to watch this movie. We have to watch this movie. We have to watch this movie. And it was just like never something that I wanted to do. But then when we were talking about doing it for the podcast, I was like, okay, let's do it. And it was kind of worth it for, you know, a one-time watch, I will say.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Anyways, all right. So that is, you know, an interesting fun fact to know about you, about how it affected you and everything.
Ew.
And kind of like the whole atmosphere of it. I totally get it, you know, especially at that age. I understand that the atmosphere can create this sense of craziness and scariness.
I feel like I need to explain that that's it. I was 9 years old. I feel like that's more what it is than anything else. I'm like, I need to explain to people that I was like 9 or 10 when I watched this. So just consider anyone who has kids who are that age, consider this movie for a child.
This is what it's for, right?
Yeah.
To understand and to explore the free therapy of it. Unfortunately, your time is up. You have to pay me a lot of money. And
absolutely
<that's it>.
Not.
Fuck.
Too bad. Okay, this was super fun. I'm really glad that we got to, because we've not watched this movie in a while
as well.
So this was actually really fun to revisit. Because partially this week we wanted to go see Over Your Dead Body, and it's not fucking playing anywhere in our
it's
area.
It's literally not playing anywhere. It's really fucking fucked
and I'm
up.
Really irritated about that.
It's
so
okay. We'll find it somewhere. We'll wait on VOD. But regardless, we have some cool, cool stuff coming up very soon.
Yes.
We are talking to a very cool horror author that we just literally had an interview yesterday, so that's going to be dropping very soon.
Yeah.
And we are also talking next week, but you're going to probably listen to it a little
in
bit later.
In a couple of weeks,
we are talking to Ryberry. Ryberry. I don't know. So anyways, he is the killer in In a Violent Nature.
Star of In a Violent Nature.
And he's coming back in A Violent Nature 2.
Which I think is being released sometime this year. We've gotten a trailer for it.
You should also totally go listen to Horror Roulette Podcast because they spoke to him first.
Yes.
So definitely check out
their episode. We did a collab episode with them where we talked about the whole movie. That episode is insane, and I've realized it.
It's fucking hilarious.
Listening back to it, I've realized it, and I never want to talk about a cuck tree ever again in my life.
If you want to understand this reference, go listen to
that episode, and then definitely listen to their interview with Rye Barrett as well, because he sounds lovely and like he's, you know, willing to come on and talk to all of us, which is wonderful.
So anyways, this is what's coming up very soon. And otherwise,
May is an incredibly stacked month for releases. Yeah. So that's going to be super fun as of next week. So May 1st is next Friday. Hokum comes out.
Yes.
And so we're going to be talking about that. May also has releases of pretty major films like Obsession, which has gotten a ton of hype, Passenger, and Backrooms.
Yeah.
So it's going to be an insanely stacked month, which means that we are going to have a lot to talk about.
We go watch it literally the first day it comes out, and then we record way too late at night.
Yes, we do. So our thoughts are... Interestingly, I feel like there's some that we almost need to revisit at different times because I feel like our thoughts will change throughout the year.
Yeah. So anyways, that is all you have to look forward to on our cool podcast.
Woo.
Otherwise, follow us at Gravetone Pod on literally any social media. That is our handle everywhere. And until next time, guys.
Stay scared and stay tuned.
Ciao, guys.